Morning. I was just telling Michael and Matt, I'm off kilter just a little bit because my signal to go is usually when my wife gets here, but she's not here yet. So, but it's getting too late, so I don't have my signal to go. But now it's she'll join us in a moment. I figure if I wait till the person with three children to take care of and get here in the morning gets here, everyone else should be here too. So that's why I wait for her. I feel like I've waited enough time if she's here. But okay, well let's get going. Well, thanks for joining us this morning for our 9:30 hour. I'd like to reflect with you just a little bit on what I'm calling the politics of hope, which in a way is going to continue some of the stuff we talked about last year when we just reflected on like a Christian conception of what government's for, that type of thing. But it's not specifically that. It's connected to that. It's a tangent to that. But it also relates to our ministry theme, which we'll read in just a moment, relating to a living hope. And I'd like to draw those two together into, again, what I'm loosely calling the politics of hope. Now, I'm going to explain what a politics of hope, what I even mean by that. I'll explain that in just a little bit. But my sense is this. The words politics and hope don't sit well together for many of us at the moment. And again, although I'm not offering a commentary on our current situation, that's not the aim here. I do hope that this will help us make some connections on connecting those two words once again, politics and hope. So we'll see. But I'll explain all that in more detail in a bit. What I'd like to start with is this. I'd like to start with returning to our ministry theme and just reflecting on it for a moment. We did this at the beginning of the year. Let's reflect on it one more time together. Our ministry theme comes from, if you can see the banner over here, 1 Peter 1:3. And we're calling it a living hope. And I just want to share the passage with you and have us, before we even get into the politics of hope, have us just reflect a little bit on what we hear in this passage. And let me offer two disclaimers. One, the passage is not like a setup for anything. I'm not needing you to hear anything in this passage and say it back to me. I'm not looking for anything. I'm genuinely just wanting us to re-engage our ministry theme for a moment. So don't feel like, okay, what does he mean by politics of hope and our government and you know, like, and how, what am I supposed to say? None of that. Just what do you hear in the passage? That's all I'm asking you. Second, our ministry theme is from 1 Peter 1:3. It's technically from 1 Peter 1:3b. Have you ever seen that with scripture passages where like they only quote a half a passage so they put the letter B? We didn't want to put the letter B in stitches up on there because we thought it would just confuse everybody. But this passage actually begins with this line, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ." That's 1 Peter 1:3a. That's the first half of the passage. And it's fine. It's good. There's nothing we're trying to exclude by ignoring it. But just to focus our attention, we're focusing on the second half of the passage. And here's what the second half of the passage says. By God's great mercy, God has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. By God's great mercy, God has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So, here's how I'd like to start. Just to focus our minds on the theme that's guiding what we're doing this year from 1 Peter 1:3. I'd just like to encourage you to receive those words. Ask yourself, what question does it raise for you? What word or idea stands out to you as interesting or troubling? Or just makes you wonder for a moment with a question or a comment, anything like that. Just ask yourself, What am I hearing in this passage? What's coming to me? What questions are arriving? What interests me? What stands out? Just ask yourself about this passage itself without any presumption that I'm looking for answers, because I'm not, I promise. Just want to hear what you have to say about it. Take a moment, and whoever happens to be sitting nearby, will you share with them what stands out to you from this passage? Let's just take a moment, take 30, 60 seconds or so. What stands out in this passage to you? Okay, hopefully you had an opportunity to reflect together just a little bit, to hear what someone else was saying, and then to be able to say out loud, articulate your own thoughts there. So let's just share for just a couple moments, not long, but just a couple moments, what are some of the things you heard or someone sitting next to you heard, wondered about, questioned, etc., from this passage? Let's share a few of those out loud. Since we do have people on Zoom, let's speak it into the microphone so that they can hear as well, because they won't be able to hear you otherwise. Yeah, Kevin.
Well, I told Amy I heard the Jesus Christ phrase often, and then she said, yeah, and that living hope through him is in me. So that's Amy focused in on that hope being not only in Jesus Christ, but Christ in us.
Right. Okay. Yes, that in our participation in Christ, the hope there is now in us. Christ indwelling in us grants us that same hope. Okay, good. Thanks. Nolan?
Margaret spoke to her experiences as before being Christian, then being born into a stronger Southern tradition or a stronger tradition that I shared as well, that hope wasn't really a tangible thing. It was much more... the hope was for the victory, through the fighting and through it was not this idea of a living idea. So her experiences were to seek out more of that balance, see what sort of order that could restore, or the idea of that there's a goodness to it, not a marshaling of troops and a rally cry of to fight,
yes,
versus to enjoy, to live in, to flourish.
Right. Good. Thanks. Yeah. I mean, a couple things there. The notion of hope being something to rejoice in, not simply something to anticipate in the future. And then secondly, the fact that hope is described with the word living changes what you hear about the word hope. We'll talk about that more next week, but that word living next to the word hope is significant. It's not just hope, it's living hope. And it's worthwhile asking ourselves what that means to us. Okay, Melinda?
Yeah, I guess on that same note, the new birth and living hope, and the juxtaposed of what does that mean to, on a daily basis, live into new birth? And that it's not maybe what... I just kept thinking of the health and wealth gospel, and that's not what this is. Mm. And so it's that new birth and that living hope is a resurrection, is a eternal hope, not necessarily a day-to-day, that means that I'm going to have a job, like Michael was saying, are we going to have jobs in 6 months? I don't know. Not that, it's not that type of, I don't have hope in necessarily earthly things. Mm-hmm. And so where do you live in that middle ground of It's not about living, about tangible earthly things. It's about eternal things. But it can make my attitude towards individuals be very different, not necessarily my attitude towards tangible things.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this eschatological end time hope that transforms the way you then see everything today and respond to things today. And it is interesting that the word, as you pointed out, birth is prefaced by the word new. There is something new about this. What is the new thing we're birthed into if it's not necessarily a guarantee of a job in 6 months, right? What is the new thing that we are birthed into at the moment? And that'll be interesting to pursue as well. But okay, thank you. Yeah, someone else has a mic. Linda.
I want Kristen to say what she said because I felt like the knot in my chest and tie a little. Well.
Did you say tighten a little or untighten? Untighten. Okay. Yes. Thanks.
This week, Matt and I have been talking a lot about just how overwhelming the news is, and I think we can all relate to that. Mm. And I have been really restricting how much I take in. And we were just discussing, you know, just how hard it is to just carry all of the pain that everyone's experiencing around the world right now. And even locally, you know, just there's so much pain. And then just something that came out of my mouth in the conversation is that's what Jesus died for, to carry that. And that I don't need to be carrying it. And so when I read resurrection, through the resurrection, it's like that's what Jesus died for, to carry that for me, so that we don't all have to be carrying that around.
Thanks, Kristen. We're going to return to the notion of resurrection because as we see in this passage and as we'll discover as we think about it further, it is in fact the foundation of everything else that comes. Everything else we're going to say and think is grounded in this claim that man was raised from the dead. And that claim will change everything for us. But anyway, good. Thank you for those reflections. Anyone else? Marty?
I remember last week toward the end of the service, and I have some reasons to have some depression, but I remember thinking, is there any hope? And I looked up and I saw, it's one of the first times the banner has really meant something to me, because when I looked up, I thought, yes, we all have hope. We're always going to have hope if we live into it, and it is a living. It's not, we do it day by day.
Yeah. Thanks. I love the reminder that we have to keep saying this to one another. It's like when you're teaching students and you teach them something on day one, and then the good teachers aren't surprised they don't remember it on day 14. You've got to say it again for them to get it, and you got to say it again. I feel like we're that way in our everyday lives, but it's like in your marriage. As we've talked about before, right? Lisa's going to talk next. Let me be careful what I say here. If I say to Lisa, on our wedding day, 27 years ago, I told you I loved you. Why are you worried about it today? She's like, well, it's been 27 years. I might want to hear it again. You know, that type of thing, right? It's good
like
to say
every
these
day.
Things. Yeah. It's good to say these things over and over. In the same way, it's good to have these words before us. It's good to hear this again and again. It's not like we haven't heard this passage before, but it does in fact call to mind what we need to hear because it's easy to let it go and forget it unless we're constantly reminded of it, which is part of the reason we gather every week, even though it can feel like, what are we doing here? It's good to say these things over and over again. Okay, Lisa, we'll move on after this, and then Margaret, and then we'll move on.
What stuck out for me was living hope. And when something is living, it takes attentive affection, right? Mm. Like you've got to water it, pay attention to it, put it in the sunshine, make sure there's no weeds. So we have this natural hope that is in us, right? The shoot comes up, it grows, but then the baby is born, right? The baby grows and is born, but we have to give it that attentive affection for it to be something more than just that little
bit. What a lovely way to put that. Thanks. Yeah. If it is in fact living, it needs to be nurtured like a living thing. Yeah, what a beautiful sentiment. Thanks for putting it that way. Okay, Margaret, Jeff has a mic for you.
I have more questions than I do making a statement.
Yeah.
My question is, what is it about the living hope that nationally we as Christians don't understand that it requires action? Anything that is living is moving.
Mm-hmm.
And when it moves, it commits itself to some level of action. And I have tossed and turned over this for the last 30 years in not understanding why we as Christians don't understand the consequences as well as the formality of a living hope.
Yeah.
And so I'll continue to listen, but that is a question that I have.
Thanks, Margaret. That is such an important question. And again, we'll return to it explicitly, actually, in the coming weeks. But it's such an important question. And what we're going to want to say, this won't be the point today, but what we're going to want to say in coming weeks is this. If hope is simply about some end time, that's not what hope means. If it's simply about an end time, it needs a different word. Hope is about the present. It's about action in the present. But we're going to get to that, hence the politics of hope. But we'll get to that. So that's an important question. Thanks for raising it. Okay. Thanks for your reflections on this passage. Again, I don't offer it up to make some big point. I just want to remind us of the theme that's guiding us this year. And just our sense, when we introduced the passage at the beginning of the year, part of the reason this passage was chosen, as we talked with shepherds and MSG and conversations with all of you, part of the reason this passage was chosen is it just feels like we're in a time where we need to feel a little bit of hope, and we're wondering what that looks like. What does hope look like individually, corporately, etc.? We're wondering that, and hence the notion of the politics of hope. So we'll get to that. But before we do, I'd like to do this for us today. When we think about the notion of the politics of hope, as with any notion, it's often useful when you're trying to figure out what you mean by something. What do we mean by hope? What do we mean by a politics of hope? What are we even talking about? It's often useful to answer that question by describing some contrasts, by saying, not this. It's not these things. And that sort of narrows the field and then helps you better understand what it is you actually are talking about. So today, what I'd like to give you is the opposites. Opposites is too strong. I'd like to give you some contrasts to the politics of hope. I'm going to tell you two stories, one ancient, one contemporary. And each of the stories has a struggle within it. There's two groups struggling with each other. So there's four groups altogether, one ancient, two ancient groups, two modern groups. And none of them is what we'll mean by the politics of hope. But all four of them are in fact ways in the world today we think about how we should live our lives. And so what I'm going to want to do is set them up as a contrast. Hopefully you'll recognize in them ways in the world today. You'll hear it and you'll think, yeah, that was from Greek mythology, but I see that in the world today. And once you have those contrasts in mind, then next week we'll say, okay, what's the alternative then? What would be the alternative to those ways of being? So that's what we're going to do today. I hope it doesn't feel too counterintuitive. We're going to begin with the negative, the contrast, to lead us into the positive, what we mean by hope and the politics of hope. So that's what I'm going to try today. And let me start by telling you about two stories. I'm not going to share stories, but two stories from history. The first one perhaps is somewhat familiar to you. This is from ancient times. And hopefully these names will sound familiar, but even if you've never heard them before, it doesn't matter. It's the spirit of them that I want you to understand. The actual stories from Greek mythology are not as essential. So the first one is Prometheus versus Sisyphus. Do those names sound at all familiar to you? Again, it doesn't matter if you don't know their stories. That's not the point here. But they're two ways of understanding the world. They're two viewpoints on the world that I suspect you will recognize in today's contemporary world. And again, I'm setting them up as contrasts. They're opposed to one another. And I'm also saying both of them are contrasted to the politics of hope. Okay, that's enough about that. Let's talk about each of them. So, Prometheus. In Greek mythology, if you don't know, Prometheus is the god of fire. But Prometheus is best known for defying the Olympian gods. And you know what he did? He took fire from the Olympian gods and gave it to us humans. He took fire from the gods and he gave it to us humans. Previously, we were entirely dependent on the whims of Zeus and his cohort. After Prometheus, once he gave us fire, and fire is meant to be symbolic here of technology, skill, knowledge, civilization. Once Prometheus gives that to humanity, humanity is no longer dependent. So it symbolizes our human ability to achieve whatever it is we set our minds to achieving. If we just try hard enough, things will in fact turn out as they should. So again, Prometheus sort of is this Greek god that stands for, that symbolizes the human ability to achieve whatever it is we set ourselves to, right? This strong ability of us humans to do things. So in a Promethean world, if that makes sense to you. So in a Promethean world, if that's your understanding of the world, in a Promethean world, our task is to continue progressing and progressing and progressing until, by our power, we bring about paradise on earth. Just continue to do that. So, in the Promethean world, the model saint in a Promethean world might be something like the entrepreneur. They're always having a new idea. They're always trying something new. It might even be the organizer, the one who's gathering the community together, right? And saying, we can do this. We can achieve it if we just set our minds to it. COVID arises. We can make a vaccine. We can do this. The moon's up there. We say, I think we can get there. I think we can do that, right? We organize. We do this. We believe it, and we manifest it, and we make it happen in the world. That's a Promethean worldview. Its mode of operation, in a Promethean worldview, the mode of operation is absolute optimism. This is possible. And the optimism comes from the second half of the mode of operation, absolute strength. We now have fire. Fire being symbolic of skills, knowledge, technology, all of that. We have what the gods have. Because we have that, we are strong. Because we are strong, we are very optimistic. We can make this world turn out just as it should. So, Promethean politics is then built on that very particular understanding of the world. We'll get to the politics later, but it's built on that understanding. So let me ask you this. As you've heard just a very brief and quick understanding of the Promethean worldview, what would you consider the strengths of that perception of the world? It certainly has strengths, and it has weaknesses. Do any strengths come to mind from viewing the world in this way? Very optimistic. We're very strong. We can absolutely achieve whatever we set our minds to. We honor the entrepreneurs. We honor the organizers. What are the positives of that worldview? What comes to mind, Jen?
Just feeling good about accomplishing something.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome to feel good about accomplishments. We did make it to the moon, it turns out. It feels good to achieve that type of thing. Or maybe even better, you know, we survived plagues. You know, those type of things are good, right? We made it through difficulties. Those type of things are make you feel great. Yeah, Dan?
It's energizing.
Yeah, absolutely, right? It is encouraging to be around optimists, and it's energizing. It energizes us when we make these successes, right? Kevin?
Thank you, Jeff. It's elevating. So we didn't have a middle class until, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And so there's been an uplifting of people and our daily lives. I grew up in South Dakota where there were half the population still had outhouses.
Right, right, you know? Yeah, right. This notion of progress is, and again, elevating is a great word for it. Good, yeah. Anyone else? Again, we don't have to do too many of these, but yeah. Kristen, you say it, I'll say it back out loud.
It gives us a sense of control.
Okay, a good sense of control, right? We do not like to be out of control. It's like you're driving your car, you start sliding on ice. It's not fun to be out of control. You have no idea what's going to happen. Being in control feels much better. This gives you a great sense of control. Here's two other positives I would suggest about the Promethean worldview. The Promethean worldview is very active. I mean, you are always doing things. It doesn't sit back. It's not passive. It's not resigned. It's very active because, of course, it believes in what we can achieve. Second, the Promethean worldview is always willing to try and do hard things, which is a difficulty in our world. I think probably for all of us, right? It's difficult to do hard things, right? It's difficult to feel motivated to accomplish hard things. Not for Prometheans. I mean, it is, but they do it anyway. So that's one of the obvious strengths of a Promethean worldview. On the other hand, what might be some of the negatives? Again, we don't need to spend a ton of time on this because I've got three more to go and I want to get through them today. So weaknesses. What might be the weaknesses of a Promethean worldview? Anything come to mind?
Lack of education.
Maybe some lack of education? Yeah, that's interesting. What do you mean by that? Right. Yes. Okay. So if you don't understand all the complexities of the world, that optimism then becomes rather naive, it turns out. Yeah. Jen?
Crushing whoever and whatever is in your way to accomplish.
Okay. Yes. One of the big negatives that comes along with this ability to achieve what you dream of is that you do achieve it regardless of the consequences. That the ends justifies the means, and that is absolutely a weakness of the Promethean worldview. Again, we'll talk about specific examples of all of these, but yeah, Matt?
Kind of surprised when you fail. Mm. It's like hope in yourself, and when you fail, that kind of can be surprising to your society.
Yes. When the belief is that progress is always possible, it is devastating, devastating when progress does not occur. And when it doesn't, then you fall into two things. One, you either change from the Promethean worldview and become a Sisyphean. Nolan, come on, I don't want to say that out loud. Stop it. Or you start ignoring it. There are absolute failures, and you just ignore them. You just ignore them and move on as if they weren't real. Again, going back to almost a naive perspective. Yeah. Roger, were you going to add one?
I was saying the same thing about failure.
What do you do with failure? Right. Yeah. Okay. And one more. Kevin?
RoboCop.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes. All of our advancements may be the proverbial cart before the horse. The advancements become more important than the people they're made to support in some way. And then the worst of that is, you know, technology takes over humanity. So maybe we could sum up the negatives with the Promethean worldview might be something like this. In the end, it can be a bit unrealistic. And again, that can be devastating once you discover it is unrealistic. I thought we could cure this. I believed it was possible, and we did not. And so it ends up ignoring real tragedy in the world. Because of its absolute belief in our ability, it has a tendency to ignore tragedy. A second weakness might be something like this. This is sort of what you guys said. There's an impatience in the Promethean worldview. Something like, I'm not willing to wait to achieve what I know we could achieve right now. So I'm going to justify doing a few things that are going to harm a few people and maybe be bad for them to achieve what I know we can achieve. And there's an impatience there that's harmful. By the way, this is sort of a side note, but in the Greek mythology, do you remember what happens to Prometheus? In Greek mythology, Prometheus's end did not turn out well because he stole fire from Olympus and gave it to the humans. Zeus condemned Prometheus to eternal torment. And maybe you'll remember the specific eternal torment when I describe it. Yes, that's what it is. Prometheus was bound to a rock, and an eagle, which is the emblem of Zeus, was sent to eat his liver. His liver would then grow back overnight, only to be eaten again the next day in an ongoing cycle. The point being, according to the Greeks who wrote all of this, the point being, the Promethean strategy, as exciting as it is, according to the Greeks, ultimately fails spectacularly. So, there's one. What's the alternative in the Greek mythology? If you weren't a Promethean, what's the option? What else are you? What are the contrasts to it? And the other one, oh wait, let me describe it first. The other one is Sisyphus. In Greek mythology, Sisyphus was the founder and king of what we now call Corinth. Founder and king of Corinth. And what he does is he reveals Zeus's abduction of Aegina to the river god Asopus. He tells on Zeus. He has some information about Zeus and he tells on him to another god. When you tell on a god, you incur the god's wrath, of course. Maybe he was a Promethean beforehand and thought, look, I'm going to do it. I'm strong. So he tells on Zeus. He incurs Zeus's wrath. Once he dies, after having tricked a couple more gods during his lifetime, once he dies, the gods punish him. And you probably remember what the punishment is. We call it a Sisyphean task even today. The gods require that he roll an immense boulder up a hill. And right when it gets near the top, every time, the boulder rolls back down to the bottom of the hill. And he is doomed to repeat this action for eternity. So, Sisyphus symbolizes the idea that no matter how powerful we are, Sisyphus was a human, by the way, I hope that was clear. No matter how powerful we are, no matter how clever we humans might be, no matter how hard we try, the reality is that boulder is never getting to the top of that hill. It's never going to happen, and we've seen it for eternity. This is the Sisyphean worldview. Nothing will turn out as it should in the end. Our destiny, the destiny of the world itself, is actually largely tragic. So, for Sisyphus, no matter how hard we try, our destiny is disappointing. So, our task in a Sisyphean worldview is to accept that the world is in fact cruel. This is the opposite of the Prometheans. Accept the fact that the world is cruel. We are prisoners within this world, pushing a boulder up a hill every single day, only to have it rolled down again. So that what we can do The only thing we can do is just find whatever satisfaction we can in the meantime. Find some forms of satisfaction, of pleasure, of entertainment to keep us going, because we all know where this is ending. There's two certainties. There's taxes and there's death. Just try and get some satisfaction in the meantime. So, the model saint for the Sisyphean worldview is, it's like the person on vacation. Like 50 weeks out of the year, you're going to have to do terrible work. It's going to suck. You know, it's just every day, the grind. But 2 weeks a year, you get to go on vacation. And those 2 weeks are glorious, except for the fact that you're worried about going to work when you get back the whole time, and it sort of ruins the vacation. But that's the ideal. Let's just be people on vacation. Let's get as comfortable as we can, because it's all going to be terrible in the end anyway. Its mode of operation is a sort of resignation. I mean, what can we do? We are not the gods. What can we do? So you just resign yourself to it. Albert Camus, French philosopher, would be like the patron saint here. You just resign yourself to it and get what you can out of life, which leads into a little bit of hedonism. I mean, it's all terrible, so I'm going to get what pleasure I can in the meantime. So those are the modes of operation. And then the Sisyphean politics, of course, builds on that particular belief. We'll talk about the politics later. I'll be more explicit about what it looks like. Let me ask you this. Any strengths to this worldview? I mean, it's depressing, right? But any strengths to this worldview? People, in fact, take it up even today, maybe even in this room. What might strengths be? What's that?
A limited view.
Yeah, it is a pretty limited view, right? And it's honoring the fact that, hey, that's all we have, so it's trying to at least be honest about it. Yeah.
Well, you can't be disappointed if you're already expecting the worst.
Yeah. One way to not be disappointed in your hopes is to not hope in the first place. And so there is sort of this resignation that provides a bit of a comfort about it. Someone else? Yeah, Jen?
They might feel grounded. Mm. Like their belief is in reality.
Yeah. Way more realistic than the Prometheans, who are blind to tragedy. They feel like, no, I'm actually living in the world as it is. Grounded, that's a good way to put it. Dan?
Sisyphus did live forever.
Yeah, hey, we keep going on and on. And you wonder about it, right? We keep living every day despite the fact that things go wrong. We just keep getting up and doing it. And someone might look and say, why does he keep rolling the rug? Why not just stop? Why don't we stop? We keep going. You know, we go on. Nolan?
You've got one life to live, so make the most of it.
Make the most of this life you got, right? It sort of focuses you in. Here's what I've got. It's not great. I'm going to get the best out of it I can, you know. Okay, good. Yeah, so the strengths, you guys have said all of these already. It's very realistic about the world. It's realistic about tragedy. It never denies the suffering that is, in fact, present in our world and doesn't seem to be going away. It just never denies that. It faces it head on, eyes wide open. It's clear-headed, and it's accepting. This is sort of like what Ryan was saying. With the Sisyphean worldview, there's less up and downs emotionally. You just take things as they come. You're less burdened because you don't get too hopeful and you don't get too disappointed. You were expecting it all anyway. Okay, on the other side, what are the weaknesses? What then might be the weakness, the negatives of this particular perspective? Anything come to mind, Melinda? Okay. Despair leads to a form of passivity. It just does. I'm not going to make a difference anyway. I mean, I'll keep moving. I'll keep pushing the rock, but I know it doesn't matter. My despair leads to me not trying anything else, right? That's an absolute negative of the Sisyphean worldview. Jeff?
Well, kind of like what you said before, we would never have gotten to the moon, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, there are some things we, in fact, can accomplish, and we shouldn't deny those. And so it's somewhat blind because the reality of tragedy, the reality of disappointment overwhelms any sense of positive that we could achieve.
People don't rally around you.
Yeah, it's not motivating. It's not particularly motivating for a society. No, no. It doesn't get people fired up, let's say, in the way Prometheus does. Yeah. A living becomes simply going through the motions to an extent. You know, and Sisyphus, the Sisyphians just say, yeah, it is just going through the motions. But what else can I do? You know, it becomes that. And a negative is that, again, this is tied to what Bill was saying, you can't ever find a meaning or a point or a purpose in the world. So the lack of motivation. It's a crisis, actually, yeah. And that crisis leads to despair. That despair leads to a certain level of passivity. I'm not going to try. I mean, I'd love it if you were not suffering anymore, but I'm pushing a rock up a hill that's just going to roll back down. So who cares? What can I do? I'm going to go on vacation. You know, I know the world's terrible. I'm just going to go to Bahamas. You know, like, what else can I do? Okay. So there are, there's a story there. Mar, did you want to add something else?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, both sides could lead to depression.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there could be mental problems on both of them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Okay, so Prometheus, Sisyphus, they're alternatives in Greek mythology. They are also, I want to say, alternatives to what I'm calling the politics of hope. I'll try and explain that further as we move forward in coming weeks, but they are alternatives to that. So just laying the groundwork. They're not the only alternatives. Let me tell you a more modern story. I'll go through this one a little more quickly, and if it's too fast, since it's 10:17, if it's too fast, I'll return to it next week. So let me just at least introduce them. Here's the second story. The second story is what you might call the difference between modernity and post-modernity. Much more familiar terms to us than the ones from Greek mythology. Briefly, modernity is a historical period, but it's also it's an ensemble of thoughts about the world, attitudes about the world that came in the wake of the Renaissance, the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment in the 16 and 1700s. The age of modernity, most people say, ended with the horrors of World War II, but we still feel its impact today. So roughly speaking, certainly oversimplified, modernity tells a story about the world that says this: the world is basically a mechanism. The world has definite laws of cause and effect. These laws of cause and effect apply to all areas of life, to culture, to biology, to geology, zoology, sociology, physics, psychology, etc. Modernity says, again, the world is a mechanism, and it turns out that mechanism is under our control. We can, in fact, manipulate it. Once you figure out the causes to all the effects, just change the cause and you'll get a new effect. And once you discover all of that, you can do wondrous things in this world. It's a cousin to Prometheus, even though it's slightly different in its outlook on it. So that our task in modernity is fairly straightforward. Figure out how things work so that we can then control them. Makes sense. Figure out how disease happens and then control it so it doesn't happen. That's the mindset of modernity. The model saint of modernity would be the scientist, right? Or the explorer who's charting and mapping the worlds, things like that. Its mode of operation is, again, like Prometheus, optimism and a touch of arrogance. We are going to figure this out. I don't know how that works yet, but I guarantee you I'm going to figure it out. That's the modernity mindset. So there's a modern politics that builds on this understanding of the world of optimism and arrogance. I'll tell you the specifics next week, but there's a politics that builds upon it. Let me just tell you a couple of the strengths and a couple of the weaknesses. You can probably think of them yourself. One, a definite commitment to progress is one of the positives of modernity. We wouldn't even try to cure diseases without this mindset that the world's a mechanism. It has causes and effects. Figure out the cause, you can impact the effect. So a commitment to progress. And in fact, we have a achieved significant things. We've advanced in significant ways. You have cell phones in your pockets right now, computers in your pockets, stronger than the computers they used to send a rocket to the moon when it first happened. In your pocket, right? Because of a modern mindset. So there are certain strengths there. Weaknesses. Weaknesses are this. Modernity tends to be a bit naive about what it is we're going to figure out. It keeps saying, no, we'll have it all figured out. Don't worry, just give us a couple more years. And every year we're baffled and confused and troubled, and it doesn't work like we thought it would. We change the causes, it doesn't turn out the way we thought it would. We change the causes again, it doesn't turn out the way we thought it would, because it was far more complex than we thought, right? Another problem with modernity is it tends to be deaf to difference. It tends to say something like, once you figure out the cause and the effect, well then I'm going to go share it with the whole world so they can be just like me. I've got the truth, you follow the truth that I have just discovered, despite the fact that you are different from me. So it's a bit deaf to difference in this mechanistic worldview. Okay, this one's going to be really fast. I'm sorry, I've gone way too late. I promise I won't do this again. That's what I said last time, and I promise it this time. Okay, postmodernity. Postmodernity, roughly speaking, again, it's a historical period that starts like 1800s. Maybe Nietzsche would be the name you'd associate most with the advent of it, but Karl Marx and others, it doesn't matter. It's an ensemble of social and cultural norms, attitudes, practices that arose in response to modernity, hence its name, post-modernity. Again, roughly begins in the 1800s, still continuing today. Generally speaking, again, oversimplified, post-modernity considers the world to be an ongoing mystery. Not simply complex, but baffling beyond understanding. No definite meaning, no definite purpose, no definite goal to the world. There's nothing we can figure out just by looking at the world. That's what the postmoderns have been saying and demonstrating over and over and over again. And this applies to all areas of life. Culture, biology, zoology, psychology, all of it. Our task in postmodernity is to accept the fact that there is a lack of meaning. But unlike Sisyphus, in postmodernity, once you accept the fact that there's a lack of meaning, you say, what's left? What's left is power. So grab as much as you can. There's no meaning in this world. There's no purpose in this world. There's no goal to this world. The world is baffling and a mystery. So what's left? Strength. Grab as much power as you can so that you're not the one that's hurt in the end. The model saint is the fittest, as in survival of the fittest. That's the model saying of postmodernity. Its mode of operation is pessimism and power. And briefly, of course, there's a politics that relates to all this, which we'll talk about next week. Strengths, it affirms mystery. It recognizes difference among people in the world. In fact, it's wide open to exploring differences and affirming them and celebrating them. That's some of its strengths. Its weakness is it believes that your might makes you right. Because I'm stronger, I'm right. What are you going to do? You have no cards here, right? I mean, that's the idea. It's a commitment to self and a commitment to tribe. That's what postmodernity is. There's no purpose, so what I can commit to is my tribe. What else am I going to do? Okay, modernity and postmodernity, competing worldviews that are going on right now. They intermix constantly. Some strengths, some weaknesses of each. And what I like to suggest is that the politics of hope is neither of those. Nor is it Prometheus, nor is it Sisyphus. So, what then is the alternative? We'll talk about the politics of each of those four next week, and then the alternative as we move forward. Okay, thanks for all that. We'll see you all back here in 4 minutes and 30 seconds.
One thing I was thinking of, talking about all these coordinate things, like, as humans,